Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
On today's show, we'll be meeting author and notorious grammarian, Lynn Truss, to learn more about her thrilling new novel.
Then we'll be heading to London's Regent's Park for a tour of this year's Frieze Sculpture with curator Claire Lilly.
And we'll be meeting up-and-coming photographer Sophie Green, who's trained her lens on the churches of South London for her new book, Congregation.
We'll also catch up with art horror auteur Peter Strickland to hear about his latest film.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's news editor Peter Firth will be looking ahead to next week's news, and we'll enjoy some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Oh, Fernando, it's nice to share the round table of Studio One with you this fine Sunday. The week started well with a bang over the water in Paris.
There was such a nice summer evening, right, Rob?
It was a romantic summer evening in Saint-Germain-des-Prés, steak frites, quite a lot of wine to celebrate a show we're making, which listeners will be able to hear a bit later in the summer, I think.
Of course, no spoiler alert here, but we had some pretty good guests. Huh?
Music, chat, art. There were many good things. It was you, me, Holly, Tully Brulet, editor-in-chief, and Andrew Tuck, the editor of Monocle, and a merry time was had by all. Is there a thing that you always have to do in Paris? Is there one? This obviously has to be a broadcastable anecdote or recommendation for our listening several. Is there something you always have to do when you go to Paris?
Well, there are quite a few things that I have to do. One, I need to buy my biscuits at the Bon Marché.
Yes.
I mean, I will do anything, but I need to get those biscuits because they're just fantastic. I don't even bring to the office because it's so good. I don't want to share
it. You don't share it. Okay. Someone lucky at home gets to share it.
Exactly.
Okay, nice. Yeah, it's a good place. And London this week has, if not sizzled in the heat, it's felt very summery. Wimbledon's been on the TV and it's kind of got into... You mean your shorts are getting shorter as the week progresses?
I loved your yellow shorts, Rob, I have to say.
So we should say that Augustin Macellari, the producer of this programme, and myself have got the yellow short memo. Means nothing on the radio. I just want to put that sultry image into our listeners' heads and to pour that bucket of cold water over that image. Let's get out the presenter of this week's News Look Ahead. He's brand new. He's from upstairs. It's Peter Firth.
Hello, Rob. Hello, Faye.
Hello, Peter. Welcome
Peter.
To the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much. It's an interesting hazing I feel that I'm about to undergo here.
Oh, yeah.
Well, fortunately, it is a massive week for news this week.
Wow.
Lots happening all over the world. Big stories, small stories, less consequential kind of medium-sized stories.
Excellent.
And so kind of have I got a news look ahead for you? The answer
Brilliant.
Is yes. So... First off, we're going to be looking on Monday, especially at some ungodly hour. We're probably going to be looking at the general election, which is currently underway right now in Greece. And so after a drubbing in the European elections, Alexis Tsipras and his radical left Syriza party called a snap election. And most analysts are predicting that it will be a cakewalk for the opposition New Democracy Party under Kyriakos Mitsotakis. And which was said impeccably by me, obviously.
Yeah.
Now, Politico describes this guy as the Trojan Trump. He bills himself as being a sort of a moderate centrist, but his party contains a prevalent kind of hardline right-leaning element.
Okay.
And
I'm liking him more and more. Okay, so general election, we get the results of the election on Monday.
Exactly, on Monday morning. And apparently the biggest thing that might frustrate his campaign is actually the weather. And it's something that he was kind of saying a lot on his campaign rallies, basically saying, even though the weather is really, really amazing in Greece and everyone wants to be at the beach and it's too mind-numbingly hot in order to turn up to the polling station and queue up, he was saying, don't forget to vote, because that's apparently a big problem. And obviously, on the continent, everybody has a sort of like a month-long holiday anyway.
Are we going next to a small story, an international story, or one of those funny moderate-sized stories that you alluded to so provocatively?
I think this is very much a moderate sort of a story.
Okay.
We'll go to the really small story on number three. So on Tuesday, the 8th, we'll be looking at the launch of Lyft company Uber's foray into helicopter shuttles. So the Uber copter service is coming to New York's JFK Airport. And basically the idea behind this is to alleviate the drudgery of the car journey from the airport to the city. So basically when you get into this helicopter, you'll be able to hail it in exactly the same way as you will a car.
And it turns up three corners away from where you wanted it to.
And then buggers off before you can get into it. So basically the flight time is about 8 minutes, but altogether it's going to take disembarking, doing the rest of it is going to take about half an hour.
It depends where you're kind of staying in New York City, right? Because if you're, you know, if it's all right, if you're staying downtown, if you're staying somewhere near it that's got a helipad on the roof, presumably you're quite well catered for. What are the off chances you're staying with a friend in Brooklyn? Maybe he hasn't. I don't know what your friends are like. Some of mine don't have helipads on the roofs of their condos.
Well, this...
I'm just saying, I mean, I feel like the poor relation, but obviously, Peter, you're not familiar with that sort of life.
Well, given the fact that chartering this helicopter and actually just getting a seat in it is going to cost about $200 or $225, it's also going to be subject to the dynamic pricing that Uber has anyway. So, you know, when you open the app and it says, book your car without knowing the price, and you're just like, okay, great.
I don't want to say this on the radio, but that is what expenses are for. But I can see this being very popular, though. I mean, A, for the wealthy, time-pressed sort of business traveller, but also just for people that have never been in a helicopter before, it's fun and you get to fly over Manhattan. That's going to be pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that also, I mean, Uber are using this new term called multimodal journeys.
Right.
Which is basically the idea that you get an Uber to the helipad, you take the helicopter, you land, helicopter. Then you get an Uber to wherever it is that you're going. So your entire journey is managed solely by Uber.
Amazing.
Well, maybe let's have a nice fresh one. I feel a bit Ubered out.
Yeah, right. Well, this one is very fresh. So on the 8th of July to the 15th of July, the biggest naturist festival comes to the west of England.
Wow, that is fresh.
Very fresh, right? Yeah. I thought this story chimes quite well with, you know, obviously you guys are talking about Midsommar, the film. And so it feels a lot like this is going to be a kind of Midsommar kind of Wicker Man style affair with numerous naked revelers frolicking together and kind of activities apparently going to include a sacred dance.
Yeah.
Which I'm not sure exactly whether that's a euphemism. Face and body painting, photography, life coaching. So you can go and be coached by a naked man.
Yeah.
Would you be keen to go there, Peter?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm gonna pitch it up the line and see if I can go and report it.
And Peter, where is this naturist West Country rampage happening?
Well, where else other than the Thorny Lakes, Langport Somerton, just near Taunton?
Peter, that was an amazingly entertaining news look at, wasn't it, Fernando?
I very much so. Maybe I'll go to the Naturist festival.
Have you been to Taunton before?
Never.
Okay. Well, I think you two, that's a writer and a photographer right away. Get the press passes printed up. Report back next week. Peter, thank you very much indeed.
Great pleasure.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to the Monaco Weekly. And in a moment, you'll be hearing from Lynn Truss talking about her new detective novel.
Taking its name from a catastrophic misunderstanding that arose when a panda bear sat down for a slap-up meal, Lynn Truss's 2003 book, Eats, Shoots and Leaves, made waves around the world for its humorous and zero-tolerance approach to punctuation and grammar.
Lynn hasn't stood still since then, however. A prolific writer, she's worked as a columnist, a radio script writer, and a novelist. Her latest book, The Man That Got Away, is the second installment in a new comic crime series set in Brighton, on the UK's south coast in 1957.
With strains of Graham Greene's classic Brighton rock, but set firmly in the English comic novel tradition, it really is one of the summer's unmissable reads. Monocle's Andrew Miller caught up with Lynn earlier to find out more.
Let's start with the new book, The Man That Got Away. It's the second Constable Twitton mystery novel after A Shot in the Dark. Did you always set out to write a series in the grand style, the grand tradition of detective series?
I did hope to do that, yes. And when I met with the editor at Raven Books, originally to talk about Twitton and stuff, she said this magical thing, could you write one a year? And, you know, wanted to see my reaction to that. And of course, I was thrilled a bit. Yes, I would love to write one a year. I do think that there's something wonderful about the idea of expanding and expanding on an idea like that. So they're characters that I already knew because I'd written about them on the radio. So I knew I wanted to write more than one book, definitely. I was very worried about how I would deal with the question of time across the series, because so often with things that you enjoy, like Endeavour or something that's set in the past, Writers feel that they have to go forward a year each time. And then before you know it, these people should have retired. They should be very ill. They should be losing loved ones, or their lives get very miserable. And I wanted my characters to stay more or less the same age, a la sort of Jeeves and Wooster. You know, I wanted them to be ever young, really. And so what I decided to do eventually was that I would move them forward a month each time. So it's always 1957. The Middle Street Massacre occurred in 1951, but Twitten arrives in June 1957. The second book is July. The third book is the August bank holiday, and so on. And if we do get as far as six, it means I can get to November and have the London to Brighton vintage car rally, which I think would be a lovely setting, what with Genevieve, you know, and all that 50s stuff that we all love. So that's the idea, because I also think if you've got a character like Twitten who is... he's the youngest, he's very young, he's only 22, but he's the clever one, and he's the one who's pointing everything out and annoying everybody. Well, if he's 35 and like that, still got no power, still annoying everyone, I mean, it's actually quite gruesome. So I think he should always be quite young, and that way it works.
A bit like, I guess, a parallel that leaps to mind is Tintin, maybe, who wouldn't have worked nearly as well as a middle-aged man.
No, exactly. It'd be awful. Absolutely ghastly. And the dog would have died. So, no, I think I love that, you know, that they are young forever, kind of. But they must move on. You know, things will happen to them. The accumulation of things, especially month by month. I mean, that's quite intense. That each month a lot of deaths occur in Brighton. But basically, they've got to be the same.
But that year you mentioned, 1957, was there a reason you were drawn to that as a temporal, if not a physical setting? Brighton is more or less where you live and where you're speaking to me from now. But mm-hmm. when you reach back to the 1957, is there an idealised version of the English seaside town you're trying to recreate?
Yeah, I think so. I did find, after I'd written the first one, I found a thing online that said that 1957 was for British people, came out as the happiest year of the 20th century. I was born in 55, so I don't really remember 1957 that well. But to me, I think that period, for working class people particularly, you know, the war's well over, rationing has finished, conscription even is coming to an end, and there are family holidays, and people were not going to the seaside every weekend, they were going once a year. But there is a sort of sense that it was a place where people had happy times. That's also obviously famously Brighton is very edgy, and you always know there would be lots of criminals and you know, it's a good place to hide. But 57, I did think, was a nice year to settle on, I have to say. And I've done so much reading about 1957 now that I don't want to move it forward year after year. I'd have to do the whole thing over again. I now know, you know, which films came out in 1957 and so on. So if ever I'm on a pub quiz team and winning on a question on 1957 comes up and would save our lives, I'll be there.
Do you feel like there are parallels, though, between the Brighton you live in now and the Brighton of, well, slightly more than, well, more in fact than half a century ago that you characterise in the book? It is, for those of our listeners who may not know it, a city with a fairly distinct and unmistakable character. Do you feel like it is a character in the novels?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I think it's, you know, it's a very interesting place. It's a place where people come to let their hair down and to enjoy themselves. And it's a place that people come and go, and no one notices you. And I mean, when I first moved to Brighton, one of the things I liked about it was so anonymous. I was moving from London, which is a very anonymous place, and I wanted something very similar. I wanted somewhere that basically lets you come and go and takes no notice of you. And I think it's always very funny that one of the most famous people who lived in Brighton in recent years is Chris Eubank. You know, he's always trying to draw people's attention. With, you know, he drive through the tiny streets in these massive American articulated lorries and things. And people just wouldn't look at him, you know, because they're, what do you think you are? You know, it's just got that sort of attitude, which I really like, actually. And it's very broad-minded, you know, it's a huge gay capital for years. So it's got a very, it is very distinctive. And it's got the sea, which is, of course, And the seaside stuff for me, I think when I write about the seaside stuff, I am drawing on personal nostalgia. It's smells and sounds and things from the seaside of my youth. And I really, really like drawing on that as a sort of backdrop to everything that's going on.
Well, quite early in The Man That Got Away, I could not help but notice that there is an amount of querying over whether the correct form when you're asking somebody a question is whether you inquire of them or inquire from them. And this is obviously a throwback to the book that I think people probably still know you best for, which was Eats, Shoots and Leaves, A Zero-Tolerance Approach to Punctuation. I was going to ask you initially if your views had mellowed at all, and then I got to that bit in The Man That Got Away, and I found myself thinking, well, I guess the answer's no. Is that correct?
Oh, well, to me, it's a joke. I mean, it is just a joke. If I'm doing a talk and I throw in the word apostrophe, I get a laugh. You know, I mean, it just is. You know, it's a bit of a temptation, really, to make grammatical remarks. You know, because I just know that people expect it and they like it. They just like it, and it is actually a plot point in the book. I mean, it is that the boy who actually corrects them. Is a murder victim. But I don't put it in purely for myself. It is actually a plot point. But I do like, yeah, I don't mind putting in the odd thing from time to time. I'm very, very careful not to. I haven't actually responded to a request to talk about the apostrophe. You know, Land's End loses its apostrophe, shock, horror. You know, we call in trust. I don't pick up the phone. I haven't done for about 12 years. So I don't want to. It's not my intention to be the Barbara Woodhouse of punctuation, but I obviously was labelled as that early on, and there's not much I can do about it.
I mean, it does seem a strange question to ask an author about a book, but is there any part of you that feels that that book has become something of a millstone? I guess even at a level of, and I'm just wondering what this must now be like, do you get even more paranoid than most authors about that one mistake which inevitably turns up in the printed finished version of the book?
Well, I do worry about it. I think, and I obviously, mistakes do occur, and it's not a millstone, no. I mean, at the time that it was all happening, it was terrifying to me. It was basically terrifying because I was being expected to lead a movement in some way. All I'd done was write a funny book about punctuation, and I was thrilled to bits that people liked it and that they bought it for their uncles and things, and it went mad. But I had to do a lot of personal deep breathing, you know, through the whole thing to sort of say, this is happening to you, but it's not who you are, you know, and one day it'll all be over. So I was dealing with all that. But mainly I just didn't want people to think that I had set out to be some sort of religious leader or sorry, a cult leader. I was doing stuff in the States and people would turn up. Kids, lovely kids, school kids, will come up with and rip their jackets open and have "Grammar Warrior" written underneath, you know. And I did, oh, ha, ha, that's really funny. Please leave me alone, you know, because obviously I didn't want to be that person. So it was, but I think I handled it quite well. And I think the book is still out there, and people have written other books, but it's still. You know, it's still being recommended to people, and I think that's a real blessing in my life. You know, it was an amazing stroke of luck. That's all it was, because there have been books before about punctuation. I wrote quite a different sort of book, but it wasn't as if I'd invented the subject. But it was almost as, you know, I was told I had, and I kept saying, no, there have been other books. So, you know, it got a bit out of hand. I think because the subject appealed to people in the media so much, quite honestly. I thought they might be down on it when I wrote it. I was worried.
No, I think journalists by and large tend towards the pedantic on this kind of stuff, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so, you know, they couldn't get enough of it. And so I had to write hundreds of pieces, appear on lots and lots of things. And that, of course, got the message out there about the book. And then there were so many people who
had an annoying person in their life who was always looking at menus and going harumph when they saw saw things misspelled or something. And he thought, oh, this is a book for them.
Yeah, I am that annoying person in the lives of a lot of friends of mine. I am somewhat embarrassed to admit. But did you ever, I guess, properly internalise or rationalise, if either of those is indeed the right word, the defensiveness of a lot of people, not just to Eat Shoots and Leaves, but also to Talk to the Hand, the 2005 book subtitled The Utter Bloody Rudeness of Everyday Life, which was basically just a plea for people to act like grown adults in public settings and so forth, and yet people did get kind of angry about it.
Yeah, yes. Well, it seemed to me that it was a good time to write that book, actually. I mean, I haven't read it myself recently, but 2005 was before social media, really. It was only just really starting up that people were attacking each other on social media. And a lot of the sort of some of the behaviour I was writing about was quite new, and that's partly why I wrote it then. I thought I should write it now because it stands out now. In a few years, it will just be accepted and normal. So it's quite a good idea to write about it now.
Are there any internal struggles against either the poor use of language or just poor behaviour that you have personally abandoned, that you've just accepted that, well, that's just the way things are done now and there's really not much I can do about it and maybe it isn't all that bad after all?
Yeah. I mean, of course, you'd go mad. You would go absolutely mad if you spent your whole life just picking on stuff. I did a thing on the radio recently about, I think it was about One Foot in the Grave, we were talking about it, and I just said, you know, don't you feel sorry for somebody who spends their whole life seeing stuff that they can't bear? You know, isn't that an awful, awful tragedy? And no one else could see it that way. They just thought, oh, he's a funny character, and he's appalling because he's spent his whole life saying, I do not believe it. But, you know, it's a horrible state to be in, and no one can inhabit that. You wouldn't want to inhabit that.
Well, the follow-up question which suggests itself, I think, is there an aspect of writing fiction which inoculates you, perhaps, against becoming that kind of curmudgeon?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've written tons of fiction. I mean, these books are new, but in the interim, I've written loads of comedies for the radio. I've done lots of monologues and dramas and all sorts of things. And they're all about what you do when you're writing, particularly, say, a monologue, is you are trying to imagine you being somebody else. And you are putting yourself into that person's position in life, their situation, their viewpoint, everything. And of course, that's what writers do. So the idea of being labelled as someone who has a particular view and sticks with it all the time is really anathema to me. I mean, I don't think of myself as that. And I also, obviously, the idea that I have spent my whole life thinking about punctuation is so obviously couldn't be true. I spent, you know, I spent 3 months thinking about punctuation to write a book about it. And that's what the book says I did. And it's clear, you know, that anyone who had spent their whole life thinking about it couldn't write that book because they would know too much. I didn't know that much. I was putting everything I knew about punctuation into that book because I'd only just found out about it, really. There were lots and lots of things that were new to me and I had just discovered. And so it was full of enthusiasm and energy because I was sort of seeing it as a subject for the first time. And obviously, you know, someone who studied it their entire life just wouldn't have that energy. It wouldn't come like that. So, yeah, it was a very small part of my life, was writing about punctuation. But I do still get fabulous. I mean, someone sent me a very funny thing the other day. He lives in America, in Virginia, somewhere near a huge sort of IT monstrosity, which they've surrounded with wooden fences. And on the wooden fences, they've hung painted bicycles for some reason that makes it look sort of nicer, you know, in some way that isn't really understandable. And then also some sayings are written on the walls, such as, don't think your ideas aren't good enough. And so he wrote to me because what he'd done was go up in the dead of night and put a colon in so that it says, don't think your ideas aren't good. It's not good enough. And he was so proud. And, you know, I'm quite pleased that someone writes to me and tells me that they've done something like that. It's really nice.
On that optimistic note, Lynn Truss, thank you very much for joining us.
Our thanks to Lynn Truss, and her new book, The Man That Got Away, is out on Thursday. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Time for some new music, Rob. From their new album, I Was Real, here is the extremely groovy Tetuzi Akiyama by $75 Bill.
We love that, Faye. That was Tetuzi Akiyama by $75 Bill. You are listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Download the free Monocle 24 app today to tune in wherever in the world you happen to be. Whether you're catching up on the news on your daily commute, enjoying a little cultural nourishment during your morning run, or seeking some recipe inspiration around the kitchen table, the Monocle 24 app allows you to tune in live or download your favourite shows to enjoy later. Get started by downloading the Monocle 24 app today. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Now, while London's Frieze Art Fair might not take place until October, Regent's Park is already awash with visual stimulation.
It's not because of the bright young things stripping down to blister in the sun, Faye, but rather because Frieze Sculpture Park has just opened. Featuring work from the likes of Tracy Emin, Lars Fisk and Vic Moniz, the park's English gardens have been turned into a magnificent temporary sculpture park.
Earlier, Monaco's Augustin Macellari went along for a tour with Frieze sculpture curator Claire Lilly.
It's a completely free event. They reckon that about 6 million people come through Regent's Park every year. And obviously the lion's share of that is during the summer. Now we're in the English Gardens, which is the sort of southeast corner of Regent's Park. So clearly nothing like that number. But I've just been talking to Nick Biddle, who's responsible for the upkeep of this absolutely gorgeous park. And he reckons over 1 million will come through the exhibition this summer. And, you know, clearly a lot of people have already been through and sat and ate their sandwiches and asked questions and been really inquisitive. And it's been a great conversation over the last few days.
That's fantastic. So when you come to curate something that's going to get 1 million visitors, because that's like practically, that's how many people went to see the Olafur Eliasson Turbine Hall thing, isn't it? That's a huge audience. Does that feel like there's more pressure on you to do something, or does the fact that it's in the park, the fact that they're coming through and the art is a kind of, not a sideshow, it becomes something very absorbing, as you say, but they're not necessarily heading here for that. Does that mean that you're working to try and do something a bit more discreet, a bit kind of more sympathetic to the surroundings and to the way people use the public space?
Well, I'm a kind of devotee, a sculptor in the open air. That's what I do up in Yorkshire and in other places. And for me, it's just the best way to see sculpture. It means that people can go up to it. Quite often they can touch it, not always, but sometimes, in some cases in this show, people can walk over some of the sculpture or go inside it. So that physical contact is incredibly important because we share the same space as sculpture. It's unlike other art forms in that respect. And I suppose I'm really thinking about how people use this space, and I'm very aware of all the paths that come in here. I'm aware of all the different types of people who come here, you know, mums with their babies and groups of children, as we've just seen. And they will come in here and they'll be drawing and they'll be using the sculpture. At the same time, I'm working for an art fair and they have customers, they have clients. So what I try to do in bringing this group of works together is something that works for everybody. So getting really important artists into this one space. I'm very, very keen to get as diverse a range of artists as I can from around the world. As many women as I can, which I think is very important. And also to have works which, you know, just by their nature, again, appeal to people who haven't ever really looked at contemporary art before. And I suppose I really hope that this might open something up for people and for them to kind of enter into a museum or gallery in a way that they may not have done ever in their lives before.
I think you mentioned getting more women into it, and that's really interesting because when people think of sort of outdoor public sculpture, maybe their minds immediately leap for kind of hyper-masculine, like huge Richard Serra sculptures or kind of interventions on the landscape. And that, you know, maybe that's a bit of an outdated sense of what outdoor sculpture is.
It's not exactly outdated. I think we're seeing shifts. I mean, we've been seeing shifts in this for a good 40 years, but it takes time. And, you know, to make outdoor sculpture, it's expensive materially. It's also difficult to do in terms of having a structure around you that allows you to do that. And I often sort of cite the case of Joan Miró, who was one of the world's leading artists as a painter. It wasn't until he was in his 50s that he began to make sculpture. It wasn't until he was in his 50s he had the money to do it. He had the studio, the contacts, the whole structure that allows you to do that. So when I see young artists making work which is physically able to withstand the outdoors, I'm just, you know, I'm absolutely delighted. And you know, we have a cyclical problem, which is that galleries will invest in their artists who have a market value. Those who have a market value tend to be men. They therefore don't invest in their women. And so you can, you know, you can see this perpetuating thing. Far more art galleries are investing in their younger artists, their emerging artists, and in women. And you see that here. So you see somebody like Jodie Carey, who's a very young artist. She's already made a body of bronze sculptures. That's the most, one of the most expensive materials that you can use. You know, it's the sculptor's material. And that's because there are people around her who are supporting her in that endeavour.
Okay, so here we are by number one, which is by Lucy Scare, American Images. Tell me about this one, Claire.
We should look at the title of this work. It's called American Images 2014, Three Cut and Polished Limestone Boulders from Lithograph City, Iowa, Mined by the Artist. So all of that information is really important. She's a conceptual artist, really working with the ideas about landscape and the natural world. Lithograph City in Iowa was a place that I think existed for maybe 30 or 40 years because there was an extremely good limestone outcrop there. Limestone is the material from which enabled printing to take place on a sort of massive scale. Gradually the stones were replaced by metal, and of course at that point the limestone industry declined in terms of this very, very high quality work. So she sort of shifted the meaning and the place of these objects into this place, into Regent's Park, using natural boulders which she's had quarried from that quarry. So in one way she's sort of playing the American land art, mostly men, at their game, and enabling us to look at some at an American landscape, and calling it American Images is, you know, really deliberate. And at the same time, she's talking about the value of a material which has gone through times of change because of the print industry. It became a very valued commodity. That industry declined or it changed. That commodity became valueless, more or less. And now she's given it an art value.
Mm. Well, this one here is by, you can tell me.
This is by Zach Ove, and it's called Autonomous Morris.
And what have we got just behind me over my shoulder?
This is by Peter Buggenhout, who's a Belgian artist.
What's interesting about where we've chosen to stand is that we suddenly find ourselves in the middle of a swirl of colour. There's this amazing face made out of Beetle and Morris Minor hoods, all different colours, reds, whites, yellows, greens and blues. Over to my left, there's what looks like a deconstructed playground slide. And then behind me is a more abstract kind of assemblage of different bits of coloured material that works kind of harmoniously with Zach's piece. So tell me about this, because what's also distinctive is that, you know, from the start we've suddenly scaled up, everything's a bit bigger.
Yes, because of where we are, this is the bit of the park where we go large, and it's really important where the Peter Buggenhout sculpture is. This is at the end of the main walk through the English Gardens, to have something that just really pulls people into the belly of the exhibition. So when I'm citing works here, I've got a number of anchor points where I need to have really significant works or works that really draw people to a point and entice them into looking at more sculptures. Really, I'm responding to the landscape all the time. And this landscape was developed, it was laid out in the 1860s. It's an extremely fine landscape with extremely good trees. So all the time I'm working with the trees, I work with the light as well. So I've sighted an Emily Young just on the eastern edge of the park, so she gets the rising sun. And it's a work that is a solar disk, so it's actually illuminated and appears like a halo as the sun hits it from behind. So all of those elements are what I work with. Do I break the rules? I've sighted a Tracy Emin on a piece of land where normally I would have something which is far bolder and bigger. But I felt that this piece, which is this extremely tender, gentle, fetus-like curled up figure, needed something that was really on where she was on her own and where she was sort of protected by the trees and bushes. And I guess all of this stuff might sound a bit bonkers, but you know, I feel about the sculpture, and so what I feel about the sculptures informs how I cite it. And that piece in particular was in the gallery, in her gallery, up until not very long ago. And she was here a couple of days ago, and she was amazed at how the colour and the tone and the surface quality of this work changed so much in natural light. And, you know, this is the beauty of sculpture outdoors. It's always changing. When we started recording this, it was quite bright sunshine. Now it's clouded over. And so you have this very different tone right throughout the day. And then, of course, as the weather changes and as the seasons change, and I know how some of these trees will change, I know how their colour will change, how some of them will lose their leaves going into October. You know, it's been a great privilege to get to know this park. And
you could spend a day here and have no two same experiences of any of the bits of sculpture in it.
Yeah. This is by Robert Indiana, who's a really important 20th century American artist. And people might know his love sculptures, where he spells out L-O-V-E in different colours, different materials. And this is another series of works that Indiana made, basically using the numbers 1 to 9. You know, it's very interesting. When you see these works in reproduction, you really can't get them, because you've got the shape of the numbers, as we would know, and this is all in Clarendon typeface, which is actually a typeface that was the very first licensed typeface ever in the world. And it was designed in London in 1845. So there's a kind of nice connection there. So here you see, you recognize this typeface. But what is surprising when you're actually with these sculptures is the depth of the works. The sculptures themselves are extremely deep. And so you get this fantastic three-dimensional quality with them. They're unbelievably beautifully fabricated. I don't know how they've managed to weld these, I really don't know. I mean, they are amazingly beautifully made. And they're made in Corten steel, which is a material which is designed to rust, and the rust becomes the protective layer of the sculpture. And over time, these will change. You know, they're sort of a light rust red right now. They're likely to go darker than this or lighter than this, depending on the weather and the level of pollution in here as well.
Here we have a sculpture which is not just very beautiful, but also kind of thrillingly quite dangerous seeming.
Yeah, it's rather dangerous. And that's because this is a piece by Jodie Carey. It's called Cord. And it's a work that she's made by laying a thick piece of rope into a bed of soil at the foundry and then pouring the molten bronze directly into that. And anyone who's seen this process can't not be impressed by it. It's just such an exciting thing. You see fire coming out of the earth. You see kind of something like a volcano. This piece is about the umbilical connection between mother and child. And so there's something very raw about it. It's really chthonic, meaning it kind of seems to come from the centre of the earth. There's hardly any work being done to the bronze once it's been lifted out of the soil. And there's barely any kind of patination. There's hardly any surface to it. You're looking at, you know, the real raw bronze as it comes out of the casting process.
You know, it is a beautiful object that does shine a light on its own process, doesn't it, in this way. As you say, it hasn't been sort of finished as you might expect, but it's kind of worth remembering, reflecting as you look at it, that the lion's share of casts, bronze casts, are going to have come out looking rough like this, that this is something that has been arrested a bit of the way through the process rather than taken all the way through as some other artists
might. Yeah, you're absolutely right, and deliberately left unfinished.
And it's just next to the Tracy Emin, which we can walk to and which, by the looks of it, has been very carefully finished. This is quite an amazing piece. You described it earlier a bit, said it was kind of like a fetus. It's called When I Sleep, and it's a large bronze, very vulnerable-looking figure curled up on its side. It kind of makes me wonder if that is how Tracy Emin sleeps.
Well, she's a famous insomniac, and clearly this is related to that. I mean, Tracy Emin is one of Britain's probably best-known artists, and her own personal life is absolutely central to her work and all her misdemeanors, her failures, her sadnesses. And she's gone through a couple of years of losing her mother, battling insomnia, and of dealing with the memory of abortion and other issues which have impacted on her life. I think this is her. I think this is a self-portrait. It was modelled from plasticine, so very roughly modelled. It was made during a period where she deliberately gave herself time to make what came out of her body very instinctively, without any natural purpose, no particular ending to the work. And this is a piece that she has decided to take from, you know, maybe a foot long and then to enlarge up to 4 meters. She's managed to retain the vulnerability, the sensitivity, the kind of tenderness of this little figure.
And what's lovely is looking at it, you know, it really beautifully illustrates the diversity of work that's on display here. We started with Lucy Scare at number one, which was also a very beautiful but a very cerebral piece, whereas this one does really go straight for the kind of emotional jugular, doesn't it? You don't have to do much thinking, you don't need much context to be able to reflect on it and to kind of get something from it. It has something of the past about it. It's like a foot out of contemporary art and into something a bit more that maybe resonates more deeply with a kind of, with everyone, really.
Yeah, it comes right from her innards and it touches our innards. Mm.
Claire, we're walking around and we've stopped by, I'll let the title describe it because it does describe it very well. We stopped by one of the sculptures and the artist is here.
Yeah, this is Lars Fisk and his work is called Tudor Ball. It's an amazing sculpture which Lars has made especially for this exhibition, and I think probably true to say in relation to the context of being in England.
Lars, it's fantastic. Tell us about it.
Well, like Claire just said, that the notion for this particular subject came from a certain understanding of this very common architecture here. So for me, it presented itself as a very logical choice for a subject.
It's got a real sense of humour. I was saying as we walk past in the other direction, it almost looks like the house at the end of Poltergeist, sort of arrested mid-collapse in on itself. It's like it's a whole house that's been kind of dragged into one sphere, but it's still kind of got the window box doggedly clinging on. And inside it's painted with the fleur-de-lis and it has this beautiful bit of thatch around the top, kind of crowning it like a hat or like a funny haircut. Is humour something that you work with? Is that something that you like to bring to your projects?
Yes. I think that just it sort of builds itself into the projects. I mean, I suppose I look at certain things in the world and respond to things that are a little funny. But yes, there's an intent to allow silliness to partake.
So we're back at the beginning now, which is a kind of noisy end for us. Standing next to a piece by Tom Sachs, which is kind of looming over. It's this big cartoon figure, which is based on a character from Hello Kitty.
Yeah, it's My Melody. So over the last few days, we've seen any number of children, particularly little girls, come in here and squeal with delight to see their favourite little cartoon character blown up to 3 metres high. So he's taken this very sort of, actually really beautifully made, you know, those characters are so beautifully made, but they're really just part of a merchandising for a cartoon that has a license. That's really what these things exist as. And he's made it in bronze, this most important sculptural material, made it large, and in the process also shown us all the kind of makings of the work. So it looks a little bit like a hobbyist might have made it.
So what it speaks to that we've seen across other of the works here, Lars's Tudor house and then this car that we can see sitting on the lawn just through the trees, which looks like a beautiful old Peugeot, but is in fact not.
No, it's actually a 1973 E-Type Jag in British Racing Green, but it's not actually a copy. It's a copy of a Matchbox toy of the same car. So, and it's the artist toy. So he scaled it up to almost life size, and it's got all the scuffs and the bumps and the what have yous that a child's toy would have. And he's used really cutting edge technology to create this gorgeous E-Type Jag. But I guess what we're looking at here with works by Tom Sachs, by Vic Muniz, who made the Jag, by Lars Fisk, who we've just been talking to, is a sense of playfulness, but also artists who are really intent on their work being accessible to a very broad public, who want their work to be enjoyed, who want it to be encountered by people who wouldn't normally go into a museum or a gallery. And, you know, that's what public art for them is, and something which really kind of pulls you into it, delights, mesmerizes, entices, all these things. And that's what you see here in Free Sculpture.
On a beautiful day like this, obviously it's opening, so there's still people putting the finishing touches on, some of the artists are around. But as the sculptures bed in, so to speak, as the season starts and people become a bit more used to it, maybe some visitors come back, others discover it for the first time. You know, if you come back and it's a beautiful sunny day and you walk through the English Garden, what kind of response, what kind of interaction are you hoping to see? What do you want audiences to be doing with the sculptures? What would be your kind of dream reaction to the exhibition?
To see them walking around them. These are all three-dimensional objects. It makes me really sad when people just go up to one side and walk away. I would say walk around, and I love seeing people having conversations, and I know that there will be conversations had in this park over the coming months that wouldn't have happened otherwise. And I love that, the way in which sculpture can bring people together, people who don't necessarily know one another. And I've seen strangers talking to one another here, and I think that interaction, that exchange, is the most beautiful thing and the most important thing here.
Augustin Macellari talking to curator Claire Lilly, and Free Sculpture will be on display in London's Regent's Park until the 6th of October. It's free to attend, and you'd be foolish not to. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. Photographer Sophie Green is fast emerging as one of the industry's most exciting new voices. Her work stretches across commercial, editorial, and documentary, but is tied together by a common concern with how people are drawn together into communities.
For her new book, Congregation, Sophie's turned her lens on the Aladura spiritualist African churches of South London. Meeting every Sunday, the services function as a vital link to cultural identity for communities from the African diaspora, while Sophie's book presents tender, frank, and eye-catching portraits of the white-clad worshippers. And Sophie joins us now. Thank you very much for coming in on the Monocle Weekly, and congratulations on Congregation.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful thing. I mean, it looks great. We've messed around with your website and it looks great on there. The book, perfectly bound book, is in front of us, and it looks extra gorgeous. I'll ask you the obvious one first, Sophie. How did you find this particular Congregations that you shot, and when did you have the brainwave to get involved to photograph these guys?
So I live in Peckham, and
it's on your doorstep.
It's on my doorstep. Yeah. Every Sunday morning, you see churchgoers flowing in and outside of the churches, and when they're kind of in their like beautiful ethereal white garment dresses, yeah, it just looks so visually. It's so interesting, framed up against the backdrop of Rye Lane, where you have chicken shops, kebab shops. Like, there's just such a weird sort of collision of traditional religious culture and modern culture. And I was just struck by this visual juxtaposition at first, and I approached this one lady that I saw walking up Rye Lane, and I asked if I could join her at her church, and they have an open or policy, anyone can go and join. So I just went and
did you feel underdressed? What were you wearing?
Oh yeah, I mean, there's a lot of many cultural customs, like you're not allowed to, women have to have their hair covered.
Yeah.
So and I was just probably in like tracksuits, trainers, hair down, and I turned up at the church, and yeah, they welcomed me and they gave me a headdress to wear, and then I just experienced this 7-hour service, and they're like very energetic, a lot of singing and dancing, and like much more expressive than C of E. It was just kind of amazing seeing this group of people uniting together through having this faith and practicing faith. And I guess that one experience just made me want to understand more about this community and how they practice faith. The whole project really is a celebration of how, I guess it's a kind of like acknowledgement of how important it is that this West African diaspora community has a kind of means to, I guess, like remember and celebrate their cultural identity here in London. And these churches create such a sense of belonging and connection and community for so many African families and individuals.
And I think one of my favorite things in the picture is how you made them look quite defiant and quite powerful as well. I love, I think my favorite photograph is of a young child, I think Yusuf.
Yeah.
He's basically looking like a pop star in a way. It's just fantastic. So how did the community receive your pictures and the result of it now that we have this beautiful book?
I spend a lot of time on my project, so I started photographing this in 2016 and I was consistently going back to the churches for 2 years photographing and taking back the product of what I'd created, like, you know, always taking back prints so they could always see the result of my time spent with them. And so I think as soon as they saw the images, they were like, oh, okay, I understand, like, this is a good thing. And they wanted to, you know, they were really keen to represent their pride in their faith and their community, and there was like a willingness to be photographed. And
yeah, that comes across. I wanted to ask you about that, because there are people that are good at having their picture taken. This congregation, certainly the people that feature in the book, are good at having their picture taken. They're looking down the lens, they look like they're very comfortable with you being there, and in fact enjoying that, and in fact kind of you're helping to represent them in a way. It seems you can read many things into a photograph, obviously.
Yeah.
That's what we're used to doing. But as Fernando was saying, they look very strong and noble, but there's also, they look kind of like they're enjoying it. Is that fair to say? Or did you need to do some cajoling, some photographic cajoling?
Well, I guess, no, it's like that kind of process of collaboration is so important to my process of working with people and making pictures. It's always important that they are kind of having a space to express creatively, are like active participants in the shoot. You know, there's the willingness for them to sort of like express themselves, and that like willingness to engage and combine with my like desire to understand more about them, and just that merge of kind of curiosity and creativity between us both was, I think, what's made...
It's a rare thing, right? The idea of collaboration. A lot of photographs, especially when you go into a foreign place, whether it's in your city or not, whether it's down the road or not, when you go into a sort of foreign place that isn't yours, you know, you can often be taking photographs or writing stories at the expense of people and at the expense of something. It seems like you really have collaborated with these people that, you know, it seems like I can completely believe that you've shown them the negatives, that you've kind of shown them the work as it's processing. I noticed that there are a few pictures, if any of them, worshipping. They're very much before and after pictures.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, I actually don't think I really took a good picture for the first year of shooting.
They weren't standing still enough, right?
Well, yeah. So that's the... When I first started photographing, I was in the churches. So I was just photographing as the service was unfolding. And I wasn't able to engage with anyone because they were... That was their sort of sacred time to worship, and it wasn't really appropriate for me to interject and be like, oh, can I stop and take your portrait? So I was just taking images that were just really reportage-y. There was no intimacy, and it was actually only when I started photographing people outside of the church after service ended that I was able to engage with people, and it became a collaborative portrait, and that's when I started to take good pictures. But it took a while to work that out, and I guess that probably also ended up that way because it took a while for a trust to establish between me and the congregations that I photographed.
I really like the work you did for Louis Vuitton, where you sort of documented one of Vermeer's paintings from the Rijks Museum in Amsterdam to a museum in Tokyo, and that had very few people in it at all, and the point was this specially made Vuitton trunk that transported this sort of priceless artwork across many continents. That was the thing. I mean, that's kind of got a certain wit to it, because it's this strange box turning up in strange places, and it is the, I guess it's the object. What was that one like? I mean, you obviously got to go to some interesting places. Seeing the unboxing of an artwork like that is obviously pretty, the uncrating of it is a pretty cool thing. What was that one like to work on that particular project?
Well, it started in Amsterdam because the trunk, the Louis Vuitton trunk, had to collect the painting from
the
gallery.
The best museum in the world, isn't it?
Amsterdam.
The Rijks Museum. I love that place.
So amazing.
Yeah.
and then I was kind of following the journey from Amsterdam to Tokyo. So there were the two shoot locations. But yeah, it was quite meticulous, that shoot, because in the obviously this painting is just one of the most famous paintings in the world. And when we were in the gallery shooting, we had like probably 100 people, curators and painting specialists, just like every move I made with the camera, they were just terrified. And then my camera
no
lens.
No pressure.
No, honestly, my camera lens nearly smashed into the painting at one point. I was like, God, sorry. But yeah, it was, I mean, that was like a great commission because I love to travel and it was a way to explore Amsterdam and Tokyo. And
I was going to ask, what's your favorite kind of theme, even when you do something editorial? Is it something a bit more fashion, lifestyle? For example, you did something with Lucinda Chambers, I think, for The Guardian.
Uh-huh.
Or you prefer perhaps to get, you know, almost like a subculture in a way?
Well, I describe myself as a social documentary and portrait photographer. All my projects, I would say, explore aspects of British culture and rarely documented communities and subcultures who are drawn together by some kind of shared interest or mutual circumstance. So I guess I'm always looking for projects that kind of where I can explore community. Yeah, I mean, I just think we have so many negative news stories and I feel like it's so important to have stories out there that sort of reinforce community and love and like people coming together and sharing identities and passions, and whether it's like boys who are like together through a shared love of cars or people united through a faith, love people who sort of find ways to connect with one another. And I think, yeah, like unity and community and love is like the most important parts of
I'll buy the t-shirt with that on. Yeah, that's fine.
Let's make one.
Let's make one indeed.
Thank you, Sophie. And Sophie's new book, Congregation, is out now, published by Loose Joints, and is available to buy on their website. You are with the Monaco Weekly.
And that, Fendo, is it for edition 522 of the Monaco Weekly. Oh, that was quite an enjoyable show, wasn't it? It's a nice way for us to spend our Sundays. We can only hope that the listening several agree with us. Peter Firth doing his first stint on the Monocle News Look Ahead. He's an amusing character, isn't he? What did you make of him?
I think he chose some great stories. I specifically like story number three.
The naturist bonanza in the West Country of England.
You know, I quite like the English countryside,
right? You do, yeah, yeah.
With some naturists, I think there'll be just an extra good plug.
I think this is just another interesting English feather in your tourist cap.
Exactly.
I think it's perfectly fine. You're not a tourist, you're a citizen. No more tourism for you. You still get the feathers in your cap, though.
Exactly.
I think that still counts. Okay, let's thank our pals behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Augustin Macellari and researched by Charlie Filmer-Courts. Our studio managers were Nora Hull and Max Bauer. And the Monaco Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Thanks for tuning in.